Thanks, Nash. It's great to be here, and it's great to think about ever-present Lambda. So as Nyayesh mentioned, I want to talk about some direct and indirect lessons we can learn from the theory of a scalar field on a causal set. So these are some topics that I'm going to cover. I'm going to talk about how we can set up a Gaussian scalar field theory on a background causal set. So we're going to be ignoring any back reaction between the quantum field and the causal set. And also because of the underlying discreteness of the causal set, we get a natural and covariant UV regularization of the quantum field. So one of the main ingredients that's going to go into this scalar field theory construction on the causal set is a vacuum state called the Sorkin-Johnson vacuum state. I will define what this vacuum state is and explain what some of its properties are. I will also talk about how we can study the entanglement entropy of the scalar field using the space-time two-point correlation function within the causal set. And I will also discuss a definition for a D'Alembertian operator on the causal set. And in particular, we'll see how we can obtain a local operator, such as a D'Alembertian, out of inherently non-local constructions. And finally, I'll talk about a proposal for causal set action, which is very closely related to the D'Alembertian that I'll talk about. Yes?
Silly question. Which Johnson is that in Soviet Johnson?
Probably not one that Stephen Johnson.
He was one of Faye Doker's PhD students.
Okay. I'm just curious, there's a few Johnsons around.
Yeah. Right, so in all of these topics, things like non-locality, retarded operators, and the space-time volume play a major role in the physics. So there are lessons that we have learned which we can transfer to other studies in causal sets where these are common features. And I'll also suggest a couple of more direct links between these topics and ever-present lambda. These direct links are speculative, so I encourage and welcome sharpening of them through discussion. So let me start with what is a quantum field theory. Typically, we can fully describe a quantum field theory by the set of its endpoint functions. So let's take a scalar field phi, for example. We'd need phi x1, phi x2, phi x1, phi x2, all the way to phi xn, where the x's are space-time points. And these endpoint correlation functions are basically quantifying the strength of correlation in the field values at these different space-time points. If we consider a Gaussian theory, which I will focus on for the rest of the talk, then we only need to know the two-point correlation function. All the higher endpoint functions we can basically turn into expressions in terms of several two-point functions. So once we have the two-point function, we have everything. The two-point function is often called the Whiteman function. That's why it's usually expressed as a W. And like I said, because in the Gaussian theory, once we have the two-point function, we have everything. Since we want to define a Gaussian scalar field theory on a causal set, all we have to do is find a definition for W in the causal set. We can do this with the help of the covariant commutation relations, or the Parles bracket, I delta. I delta is also sometimes called the Pauli-Jordan function, and we can express it as the difference between the retarded and advanced Green functions. The advanced Green function is just the transpose of the retarded Green function, So we basically just need to know one of them in order to obtain the space-time commutator. And in a causal set, we know what the retarded Green function looks like in a number of cases. In particular, in two dimensions, we know the retarded Green function for any causal set that's approximated by any space-time. And in four dimensions, we know the retarded Green function for causal sets approximated by space-times with constant scalar curvature. So for example, Minkowski space-time or de Sitter space-time. And another observation that encourages us to use the space-time commutator in our construction of the quantum field theory is that the kernel of the Klein-Gordon operator is equal to the closure of the image of delta. So the image of delta is, if you think of delta as an integral operator, it's basically whatever it acts on that produces a non-zero output. So basically, the set of its eigenfunctions or eigenvectors with non-zero eigenvalues. So this tells us that the eigenvectors or eigenfunctions in the image of I delta span the full solution space of the Klein-Gordon operator. Now, in many settings that we want to define our scalar field theory, for example, in bounded regions of space-time, I delta is a self-adjoint operator. So it's going to have positive and negative pairs of eigenvalues and corresponding eigenfunctions. So we can expand it in terms of its positive and negative eigenfunction, eigenvalue pairs. For example, in such an extension where the lambdas are the positive eigenvalues, the u's are the corresponding eigenfunctions, and minus lambda are the negative eigenvalues, and the v's are the corresponding eigenfunctions. Now, a valid definition for w is to restrict to this positive part of the decomposition and call this to be the Whiteman function. And this choice is called the Sorkin-Johnston Whiteman function, or the SJ Whiteman function. It satisfies the two conditions that any Whiteman function needs to satisfy, those two conditions being that it be positive semi-definite, and its anti-symmetric parts give you the space-time commutator. And everything I've talked about so far, we can carry out in either continuum space-times or causal sets as long as we know the retarded Green function. So the procedure was to start the retarded Green function, get the space-time commutator, take the positive part, and get W. So we just need this. And as I told you, we know what that looks like in a number of causal sets. Also, with any definition of a two-point function comes a definition for vacuum state. So the vacuum state corresponding to this SJ Whiteman function is called the SJ vacuum state. And notice that this way of setting up the quantum field theory is different from the usual canonical quantization method for setting up a quantum field theory where you use equal time commutation relations. We're using non-equal time, fully space-time commutation relations. And because we're in a Gaussian theory, once we have W, we're done. So we know everything there is to know about the theory. Let me say what some of the properties of this SJ vacuum or Whiteman function are. We need to know the entire space-time volume in order to determine it. So I delta is being diagonalized in the full space-time volume. In particular, we need to know both the past and the future. This prescription gives us an observer-independent vacuum, which is unique. In static space times, this SJ state agrees with the one that's picked out by the time-like and hypersurface orthogonal Killing vector, which is the one people usually like to work with because it keeps the symmetry in the space-time. The state isn't necessarily Hadamard itself. So Hadamard means that the leading divergence in the coincidence limit is similar to that in the Minkowski vacuum. But a family of Hadamard states can be constructed from it if one wishes to. One may or may not. And this definition of vacuum state furnishes the definition of entanglement entropy that I'm going to talk about in a few slides with a pure state, meaning that if we look at the entropy in the SJ state, we get zero entropy. Whereas if we look at the entropy in a smaller region, smaller space-time volume within the full volume that the state was defined, then we would get a non-zero entropy because it's not a pure state any longer.
Great. Nice.
Yeah.
So when you define the Green's function on the causal set, you have to somehow come up with a map of response. So you have, let's say, an element of the set here, and the Green function tells you how one element responds to a source at the other element. Like if you perturb it here, how it will respond.
Yes.
But you have to map it onto a real number because you need to get a function.
Right.
So how deterministic is that choice? So many choices you can make.
So,
the function.
So if we're in a globally hyperbolic space-time, then there's a unique choice for the retarded Green function. If we are not, then you're right.
I think it's asking about the current set.
Is that the question? So there's that part of it, and then within the causal set. So, like I said, we only know the retarded Green function for a handful of different cases. And that's partially because we don't know how to obtain this retarded Green function from some first principles argument. In some cases, in the continuum, it has such a simple form that we can identify natural quantities in the causal set to identify with it, for example.
So you go again, sort of,
yeah,
the designer,
yes,
approach. You know what you want, and
yes,
there are examples in the continuum in which you know the function, and you know what it corresponds to,
yeah,
in the causal set. Okay.
I think right now is the case, but I think eventually, you, because when you define the Lambertian and the causal set, then you don't need the space-time anymore.
Well,
you need a dimension.
Yeah.
You need at least a dimension.
Well, it's just
that
a definition of your Dalembertian.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
So I mean, right now you're just inheriting the Dalembertian from your continuum or your Green's function from your continuum. But eventually, you just define your Dalembertian, your wave operator, on the causal set, and then do everything with that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll get to that. You have the option of defining your Green functions from the Dalembertian, but you have also the option to go the other way around and define your Green functions this way. And then there isn't necessarily a natural Dalembertian in the causal set that would.
How do you define it? I mean, here you need to have a Green's function to define.
We start with the Green function.
That's
we don't.
So you always
right.
start from Green functions. So.
Right, but we can invert something related to the Green function to get the Dalembertian. It's the mapping isn't necessarily from Dalembertian to Green function.
Sure, it could be one way or the other, right? But you have to assume something from one of the two.
Sure.
I guess the question is, which is a more natural thing to put on the plot set?
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to use any information from the continuum versus not using information from the continuum, it seems like, okay, in all of these cases, you'll have, you know, anything can be a Dapper version. It's just that when you're making the continuum correspondence, you want it to look like a continuum Dapper version. So I think there is a fundamental question, which is how did these things appear? That, I mean, if you're looking at a scalar field on a causal set, an arbitrary causal set, which is not like a continuum, then you know which Dalham version should you use is not intrinsically defined.
That's okay.
Here you're just using something that we're using the continuum approximation. So you're sort of using that as a way to say that okay, this particular Dalham version would be preferred to this particular Green function. But in principle, you can just define any one of them.
Yeah, no, I can understand.
Yeah.
And there is value in that. In continuum, you get things that look like they're supposed to, and then, but you still have a theory for
to display the picture
when you're in that regime.
Yeah. Ideally, it would be nice to have another arrow here that takes you from something more fundamental to the Green function, but we're skipping that step, which we don't know yet, starting. Given that you somehow know what an appropriate retarded Green function is, this is how you would proceed.
Are you going to talk about that, the Lambertian and the causal set?
Yeah, I will.
Then,
yeah.
I mean, you already, I guess, have some idea about what that is.
That's one proposal, yeah.
Just to stress that once you decide what the Green's function is, you don't have any more reference to space-time. And if you use the natural two-dimensional Green's, one would be suggested by two-dimensional space-times. That's defined. That is a very simple Green's function. You'll probably show it, and that can be used in any causal set, whether or not it resembles the continuum at all.
Okay, so moving on, this SJ state has been studied in a number of cosmologically interesting space-times. For example, it's been studied in FRW, where, for example, an interesting result that was obtained there was that in the SJ vacuum in FRW, correlations on superhorizon scales were obtained, and I'll say a bit more about that later. The state has also been studied in De Sitter space-time, mostly in the continuum in this work and mostly in the causal set in this work. I will say more about this work in the next few slides, which is recent work I did with Sumati and Noman. And an interesting result, which I'll already highlight from this work, was that we found that the SJ vacuum in four dimensions seemed to be a new De Sitter invariant vacuum, new relative to the known vacua, which I will review. And a question to keep in mind also is whether or not we can learn something interesting about the early universe from the SJ vacuum. So before I talk about the SJ vacuum in De Sitter, let me say a little bit about the other known vacua in De Sitter. So there is a two real parameter family of De Sitter invariant vacua called the alpha vacua. The alpha equals zero vacuum is special because it's the only Hadamard one, and it's called the Euclidean or Bunch-Davis vacuum. It has some other names too. And the Whiteman function in the Euclidean vacuum takes this expression. F is a hypergeometric function. Z is the geodesic distance with respect to the one higher dimensional Minkowski embedding of the De Sitter space-time. And an interesting point is that it is usually said that there is no known De Sitter invariant Fock vacuum for the massless minimally coupled theory.
What is alpha?
Pardon?
What is alpha?
Alpha? So it's just one of the two parameters that define the stereo parameter family of the Sitter invariant vacua.
It doesn't show up in the formula WE.
Right, because this is the form it takes when you plug in alpha equals zero. I haven't shown what the full alpha, the arbitrary alpha vacua look like. I've just explicitly shown what it looks like for alpha zero. It's beta, but for this particular case, again, if you set alpha to zero, the dependence on beta drops out, so it doesn't matter what it is.
Alpha and beta, I don't remember, is that like for Golubov coefficients or just
So they're related to the form the solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation take in the Sitter spacetime. There are some, I guess, hypergeometric
so the
family.
There's a massive solution.
So. Well, I mean, you could do it in Bogolubov coefficient, I think. So I was thinking of that. Maybe that's, yeah, anyway, sorry. You should probably do this.
I guess there's a question, what is meant by a fog vacuum?
Yes.
Which we, I don't know if that's a can of worms that should remain closed.
That is a can of worms, but whether it should remain closed or not, is it?
I guess a lot of confusion.
I mean, I think what it is, they construct it out of the modes of, linear solutions in the Sitter, right? So.
No, and also that they use, the inner product, I mean, the sort of the L2 norm, whatever we call it.
I won't go into the details, actually. I'll just show some results because, there are lots of subtleties in all of these discussions. But I just wanted to show the results that we obtained for the S.J. Weidman function and the Sitter spacetime. And we modeled the Sitter spacetime using a causal set. And we can't sprinkle into the full infinite volume the Sitter spacetime. So in this metric and conformal coordinates, we sprinkled up to some t maximum, where t ordinarily goes from minus pi over 2 to pi over 2. So in this plot, we set t max to 1.5. So compare that to pi over 2, which is in. And these are results for two dimensions. So we have the real part of the Weidman function versus proper time for the left side plots and proper distance for the right side plots. The upper two plots are for the massless theory, and the lower ones for the massive theory. And whenever we look at causal set data, we are expecting to get some scatter. This is what reflects the Poisson statistics. Except for the massless results, the two top plots, the scatter was a little larger than we'd expect. And also, as we increased the density, the scatter wasn't really shrinking. So this led us to believe that our two-dimensional massless SJ vacuum is not necessarily the Sitter invariant. Now the massive ones, so the two bottom plots, they show relatively low scatter, and the scatter decreases as expected as we increase the density of the causal set. And the red curves shown in both cases are the Euclidean vacuum Weidman function. So in the massive case, the two-dimensional SJ vacuum agrees with the Euclidean. In the massless case, it doesn't agree with it. And as I mentioned, it is said that there is no Sitter invariant vacuum for the massless theory.
This is 2D, you said?
This is 2D, yeah.
And the Green's function is, did you give the formula for the Green's function?
No, I haven't yet.
Oh, you
but
will.
Yeah, I will show it for, so in two dimensions, it takes a universal form. So for another example, I will show it to you, but just remember it's the same form for this case.
So it's independent of the fact that you're doing the sitter, it's just.
Right.
Because it's conformally flat.
Because it's because every 2D.
And these are some results in four dimensions.
But even for the massive case, it's universal. That's what I was forgetting.
Yeah. You can show, you can actually calculate, you can find it out for it's conformally related. And the Green function, you can calculate the Green function. And you see that it's the flat space time form is.
Isn't it a general fact, if you know the massless one,
then
you can
always generate
the compute the massive one from
yeah.
it. And the massless one you know because it's conformally flat.
And here too, in 4D, in the 4D case as well, you can show that the standard 4D Green function, the Minkowski one is the same.
So here are some results in four dimensions. Again, the left side plots are for time-like related pairs of points, and the right side plots are for space-like related pairs of elements. This time, I'm not showing you the scatter plots. I'm showing you the average values of the data with uncertainties that are so small you can't see them. And in the upper two plots, I am holding fixed the mass to some fixed non-zero value and varying the size of the de Sitter volume that we are considering. So we are varying this T max parameter and showing that the curves do find some convergence. And this blue line is the Euclidean value, which clearly doesn't agree with the curves. And the lower two plots, we're holding fixed the space-time volume for this specific Tmax value, and we're varying the mass. And in particular, notice that nothing special is happening as we go from non-zero mass to zero mass. This zero mass case is the case that's supposed to be ill-defined, but we're not seeing any special behavior happening in this limit. And the curves look to be the Sitter invariant. They are a function, it seems, only of geodesic distance. So this is interesting. And in this one, there's potentially something interesting in this transition from positive to negative values. I don't know.
Sorry, what was that positive to negative values of?
Of the Whiteman function.
Oh, the fact that it's
just,
I see that it
it's
changes.
Just an observation.
Which is the limit of the mass zero, the top one?
The top.
So why is there a peak? Like, do you understand it? For example, causal case,
right.
Why is the peak at like 0.5? Is there a reason for these features?
No, I mean, we expect some modification at these small scales, but we don't necessarily know why it takes a specific form.
Yeah, I think it's very, so there's no sort of, I think there's no sort of analytic understanding of why we get these curves. And I think that essentially the point was that the convergence was important to tell us that we're in sort of the asymptotic regime, but once we are, then we say, well, this is what the causal set vacuum looks like. It has these, you know, these features that are absent in the continuum version. I don't know how, but the question then is, yeah, so we don't know why they're coming for sure. We don't understand it analytically. But they seem to be persistent. They seem to be there.
So that I mean, naively, I would think that it's an indication of some characteristic
scale,
length scale,
presence
in your system, if your correlation peaks at some.
Well, I mean, there's the Sitter length, and then there's a mass scale, like a Sitter to a scale, so it can be.
But as you change the mass, I mean, that's the space-like case, which is not really what you want, right? You want the other one.
In the Dirac case as well, you have, the causal one, you have peak is not really shifting.
Yeah, they don't care about the mass.
Yeah.
So there must be another scale.
It should be the Sitter length.
That's a good point. I think we never thought about this,
I think the Sitter length is roughly one.
Yeah, so... So do you think that it's peaking around one or maybe.
But just anticipating, if you were to follow it up with some phenomenology, any kind of feature like this would likely dominate what you get. So if you have a correlation function with a feature, that's gonna determine the phenomenology.
Right. Okay.
So if that's dependent on some assumptions, it's good to understand what sets the scale.
So do they, so you're saying these don't match any alpha vacuum?
No. So,
and
right.
How do you know that? Have you?
Yeah. I mean, so most of them basically have the same form as the Euclidean one. They're just shifting a little bit, different magnitude.
Uh-huh.
But for example, they would all have this kind of diverging behavior, and none of them would have a...
You just combine alpha vacua. Is that a superposition of alpha vacua? Is that a sensible thing?
They're inequivalent vacua,
if an alpha vacuum is a state, you can define a superposition of the states.
This is plotting the wet wing function. This is a plot of the...
Python
function is not a
plot of
the state. It's
no, but I understand. So then you would just average over Python functions of different alpha.
Yeah, but if you plot the Euclidean, this is just the Euclidean one. If you plot the others, they're way off. I mean, so any of them, if you plot, they sort of they're way off the scale. They're just this.
What? No, but I mean, I don't know. What's wrong with the combining different alpha vacua? Is there something wrong?
I mean, technically, they're probably in different Hilbert spaces, but leaving that aside, wouldn't there be cross terms? Even if you superimpose the states, when you take the expectation value, it'll be cross terms in addition to the diagonal.
Okay.
So it won't just be an average, actually. I mean, the new Weidman function will not just be an average of the two that you combine.
But if you did plot all of the alpha vacua of the Weidman functions, and it's plot because it's sort of way off. I mean, they don't.
I think I've also tried taking a data set and just fitting for best fit alpha and beta, and looking at the result, and it's a pretty bad best fit.
If you use a Bayesian approach, then you take the best fit. You say it's okay because I don't know anything better. Anyway, that's a joke.
I guess I don't understand why you could not think of a superposition of alpha vacua. I mean, you say that live in different Hilbert space, but I mean, is this that would be like probably the singularity structure or something? So if you're not looking. You don't care about like what happens at exact coincidence, which I mean you don't if you have a problem. So then could have a superposition of the
So let's say you did. You still have to do isn't it a hard computation to see what the resulting two-point function would be?
Well, you have a free function there. So you probably get what the
because you take he's saying that now you take. You can combine it in any which way you want, and that's a particular state. So you want
it's
to
a particular state, but how would you, even if you knew what it was as a vector, which I'm not sure is easy to find out, you'd still have to do a computation, to get the off diagonal.
That you have to do that.
I mean, so he's saying this calculates the Weidman function as. Something which has not just alpha and beta in it, but also has a vector inside there, which
like
is
f of alpha or something.
Yeah,
yeah,
and then for any arbitrary one, but the question I think
but
is more, what does it mean? What would it mean to be then that state? Because you normally think of these as irreducible representations, and they're unequal.
But they would be only reducible, I guess, in continuum. So. I guess I'm just thinking if you have a bunch of states that you could choose to be, choose for, in general, you're in a superposition of them. So that's what I'm saying.
So if you wanted them to match with this, then one would say, well, okay, there's something that does match. What does it tell you? It still tells you that it's not like anything in the continuum.
Yeah,
the point is that in the continuum, there's this idea that you have these inequivalent alpha vacua.
Yeah.
And that, you know, they're just different quantizations which don't talk to each other. So maybe there's some way of combining them all and getting this, but it's still going to tell you it's different from the vacuum, the continuum.
Can I think about, you pointed out that if mass equals zero, there's nothing special seems to be happening. But in the other one, the scatter was much greater for m equals zero than it was. Does one see that here? I mean, you're not.
No.
So the scatter remains small for all of them, or?
Yeah. It decreases with increasing density.
So it decreases with increasing density.
Yeah.
So 4D is quite different from 2.
Yes.
Is that to do with the form of the Green's function in space-time in 4D, as in having some sort of nice better limit from mass to masses or something, how you pick that up in the causal set?
Yeah, I mean,
not necessarily in flat space, you don't have any issues with either dimension.
Yeah, the Green function singular, it's not a singularity of the Green function.
I was just thinking about the Minkowski 4D Green function, masses one. How the causal set you would pick that up when you're doing your sprinkling and getting like the function. This is just like on the light.
So maybe suggest that move on this one.
Yes. Okay, moving on to a different topic, entanglement entropy. So there exists definition of entanglement entropy in the same vein as this SJ vacuum that I just defined. And a reason in general that we might be interested in studying the entanglement entropy of a quantum field is that in many cases, for one reason or another, we don't have access to a quantum field in some region of space-time. The obvious example is a black hole, where an outside observer doesn't have access to the degrees of freedom inside of the black hole. But more generally, it can happen as well. And as a result of this limited access to the quantum field, we lose the information about its correlations, where one or more points are inside the accessible region and one or more points are outside the accessible region. And as I mentioned, this correlation information is the information content of the quantum field theory. So we want to have a way of keeping track of the information that we lose as a result of not having access to some region of space-time. And entanglement entropy gives us this measure of the loss of information that results from in access to these correlations. Before I get to the space-time definition of the entanglement entropy, let me review the conventional definition of it. So the usual story is that the entropy is minus trace rho log rho, where rho is a density matrix, typically on a spatial hypersurface sigma. Now, if you imagine that you divide sigma into two complementary regions, A and B, and we don't have access to either A or B, we can trace out the degrees of freedom in the inaccessible region, for example, B, And what we end up with is called the reduced density matrix associated to region A. If we plug it back into the formula, we get an entropy which is identified as the entanglement entropy between region A and region B. Now, crucially, we'd get an infinite answer if we were to go ahead and compute this for the non-UV regularized quantum field. But if we regularize the quantum field with a UV cutoff, then we would get a finite and meaningful answer for the entanglement entropy. But in the construction that I just reviewed, because we have the density matrix on a hypersurface, we'd usually be choosing our UV cutoff on the hypersurface as well. For example, it would be something like a minimum distance between region A and region B. So it would be a spatial quantity and it wouldn't be covariant. So we would like to have a more covariant and space-time definition of entanglement entropy. And even if we were okay with this definition, as Samati talked about yesterday, we don't have a way of talking about Cauchy surfaces in causal sets. So we wouldn't even be able to do this non-covariant calculation if we want. Now, there is a space-time definition of entanglement entropy, and it uses the familiar W and delta that we saw before. And the definition is to take this sum over solutions lambda for this generalized eigenvalue problem involving W and delta, and excluding the eigenvectors in the kernel of delta. If we plug in the S.J. Weidman function, all the lambdas are ones and zeros. So this gives you zero entropy. And that's the sense in which it provides a pure state for this entropy. Both W and delta are space-time quantities. So we can easily consider a sub-space-time volume within a larger one. And then when we compute the entropy using this formula, we can identify the entropy as the entanglement entropy between that subregion of space-time now and its complements. And again, we have both W and delta through this once we have the retarded Green function in either causal set or continuum. Okay, maybe. So I'll just quickly go over a specific application of this entanglement entropy for this system of nested diamonds in causal sets. So it's a 1+1 dimensional system, and the usual spatial convention to compare it to would be the entanglement between a sub-interval within a larger interval, where the intervals would be the diameters of these diamonds. But we're now considering the full space-time causal set that is the domain of dependence of that interval. So here we now see what the retarded Green function looks like in two dimensions. So remember, this is valid for any causal set approximated by any space-time. In this case, we're interested in flat space-time, but the de Sitter formula would have been the same. So the retarded Green function is basically proportional to the causal matrix, which is a matrix where we put ones whenever two space-time elements are causally related and zero otherwise. The diagonal also has zeros. For W, we construct the SJ W out of this Green function. And here's a plot of the S.J. Weidman function in this diamond causal set, along with the Weidman function in Minkowski spacetime with an infrared cutoff. That's what this black curve is. So the two agree pretty well. So our Weidman function in the causal set is approximately something like the Weidman function of Minkowski space with an infrared cutoff. And there are some subtleties in carrying out the entanglement entropy calculation, which I won't go into, but they are related to the fact that dividing the kernel and image of delta in the causal set is fuzzier than it is in the continuum. So here is the final result for the entropy of the sub-diamond with respect to the bigger diamond versus the UV cutoff, which is just the density of elements in the causal set. And the best fit curve is a logarithmic relation with respect to the UV cutoff with a coefficient of roughly 1/3, which is the expected value for 1 + 1 dimensions. This is the area law in 1 + 1 dimensions. It's really the constant part is really the area law, but the log part is the expected sublimit. So, and currently with Sumati and Noman, we're studying the entanglement entropy of regions in de Sitter space-time bounded by different horizons, for example, the future and past horizons of an observer and their intersection. And preliminary results that we have suggest that we get area laws in that case as well. One thing I want to mention is that this end.
You said you wouldn't go into the subtlety, but is the subtlety for the de Sitter case the same? I mean, is there any new considerations, or it's you basically make the same cutoff and so on?
Yeah.
Eigen values.
So again, one finds a large number of non-zero but small eigenvalues in the spectrum of delta.
And there's some rule for choosing where to cut.
Yeah, so that
I'm just asking,
yeah.
Is that rule sort of a new? Does anything new happen in the?
Yes, but that's a whole. Yeah, it's what we think is an extrapolation from what we found in the diamond case. So this entropy formula has broad applications. In particular, we don't have to necessarily apply it to study entanglement entropy of regions that have necessarily overlapping Cauchy surfaces, instead of this, we can have this if we wanted to. It's just harder to interpret it because we can't relate it to something else that we know. Another possibility is if we have some causal set with some number of points, we can consider the entropy resulting from considering a coarse-grained entropy by taking roughly some percentage of our causal set elements and looking at the information we lose from not considering the remaining elements. And because of the form of the formulae, which are space-time quantities, we can really make this separation into any two sets that we like, whether they are localized in space-time or not. And also, in recent work, we've seen that the formula actually applies in some non-Gaussian theories as well. So it might be an even more universal formula than we think at this point.
Do you have to assume the state is a global pure state?
Pardon?
The state you use, you assume it's a pure state?
So you can plug in any W you want there. It's just a matter of interpreting what the entropy that you get out of it is. You can have the entropy with respect to a non-pure state if you want, but
then
it's not necessarily entanglement entropy as one usually thinks of it, which is with respect to your
state. So I guess when you consider one region instead of another, the other region should be, usually should be the global region.
Yeah. So the freedom is in the subset region, if you want to retain the purity of the original.
You could do something like take, not have two regions, just have one region, but a thermal Whiteman function for that. Then you would get the thermal entropy.
But also in particular, like it's easy to consider a subregion that has like disjoint parts, which I think is computationally hard, maybe in some other formulations of entropy, but it's no different doing the one subregion case versus disjoint set, which is, I guess, this is an example of, the coarse graining is an example of that. Okay. Now, I wonder if entanglement entropy can somehow be used to model cosmological inhomogeneities. So this would be nice because it would be a quantum mechanical way of modeling it. And as I mentioned, there were some results from studying the SJ vacuum in FRW, which showed that there are correlations on superhorizon scales. And these appeared without the help of something like inflation. They were intrinsically there in the vacuum state. And since entanglement entropy is measuring the information we lose from losing access to correlation information, be it by horizons or some other reason, it may be able to pick up on inhomogeneous structures. I don't know exactly how that would pan out, but potentially some argument can be made. Some maybe hand-waving way that could happen is that consider some early time where dense regions are forming. And then consider some later time, but still early time. And then let's look at the entanglement entropy associated to the past light cone of some observer over here. And we can keep doing this by sweeping this light cone across this time, so we'd get a bunch of light cones. Some of them will contain these dense regions, some of them will not. So maybe the entropy can somehow pick up on these structures, or some other argument of this form can be made. That would be interesting. So let me shift gears now and talk about the D'Alembertian. So as we talked a little bit about before, one typically inverts D'Alembertians to obtain Green functions, but I told you about some independently defined Green functions that we have on the causal sets. So we can try and reverse the process and go from these Green functions that we know of, which I talked about in the SJ discussion, and try and get a D'Alembertian. Now the Green functions, for example, in 2D, where they're closely related to the causal matrix, and in 4D, they're related to the link matrix, which is very similar to the causal matrix. It just consists of information about causal relations with no intermediate relations between the points. So if you had some So in C, the XZ entry would have a 1, but in L, it would not, because there's an intervening element. So that's the difference between C and L.
So you count the number of links or something like that.
So L just puts ones whenever there is a link without no intermediate point. C puts a one whenever there's any relation mediated or not. So because the diagonals of both of these matrices are zero, we can't just directly invert them. We need to either by hand put some non-zero value on the diagonal or take the symmetric part of them or something before we invert them. And both of those things have been done. And it's been shown to give fairly good agreement with the box operator that we have in the continuum. But as I mentioned, we don't know what the retarded Green function looks like in general, so we can't always do this. And there's also a worry that the procedure isn't fully frame independent. So this led to a search for a more direct definition of the D'Alembertian using things that are more intrinsic to the causal.
Okay. No, not that one TV. Aha. That's an interesting. What did I tell you? I saw it.
Thank you.
She's a friend of ours.
Yeah.
Oh,
with the baby. I completely understand.
So there was a more direct definition of the D'Alembertian that was found. So if we want to know the value that box phi takes at point x, in two dimensions, it takes this form where we sum over values of the field at elements y that are related by different layers of precedence to the point x. So this layer one is just points directly linked to point x just by one link. Layer two is points related by some length two path. And layer three can either be this or this. So you sum over all possible relations, and in matrix form, it looks like this. So the diagonals all have minus 1/2, and we put 1, minus 2, or 1, depending on the cardinality of the order interval between points n and x. Or point x and y. One interesting thing about this is that if you were handed a matrix B, you can actually go back and reconstruct the causal matrix C. So that means that this B matrix has all the information in the original causal set. This is the four-dimensional expression. We just need to sum over one additional layer. And note that in both cases, the sums involve constant coefficients that alternate in sign. And when this was originally studied, one looked at the form that the continuum D'Alembertian operator took on realizations of causal sets. And one noticed that the values roughly evenly were distributed among positive and negative values, and that kind of motivated looking for such an expression with alternating signs. Some other features of the style inversion, to reiterate, are that it's linear, it's retarded, so we're only defining it using these past relations, and it's invariant under relabeling of the causal set elements. A very interesting result that was found was in taking the continuum limit of the average of the style inversion operator over all sprinklings of causal sets. It was found that that limit took this form of box minus a term that involved the scalar curvature. So this led to a proposal by Benincasa and Dauker for an action functional for causal sets. So more precisely, if you act on the box with a constant phi, just get rid of the box term and get the right sign for the R, you would get the R term that you find in the gravitational action. And in two dimensions, after you carry out the sums, it takes this simple form. In 4D, it takes this simple form. So the n's would just be the number of such relations that you would find in the causal set, the cardinality of such paths. Even though the average of the box operator over all sprinklings agreed well with the continuum box operator and continuum box operator, any particular realization of it on a particular causal set was found not to. There were fluctuations. And the fluctuations were growing with increasing density. This led to an intermediate non-locality scale being introduced in order to damp the fluctuations. So the original box operator was modified to some expression involving this intermediate length scale, which I'm not going to explicitly write out, but again, it involves alternating signs in the sum, and we have some function that depends on the cardinality of paths and the new length scale L sub k. And effectively, what this is doing is it's smearing out expressions above this new length scale L sub k. And again, if we look at the average over sprinklings and continuum limits, we find that we get the box operator and curvature term if our field phi varies slowly over this non-locality scale, if the radius of curvature is much bigger than it. So we've arrived at a d'Alembertian operator and action that's defined in this intrinsic way using just the number of paths of different lengths. And it's fully Lorentz invariant. And for this, for these cases with the extra non-locality scale, each realization of it with high probability agrees well with the continuum expression. So this is the expression for the gravitational action. We have the R term, which we found how to get from the causal set down inversion, but there's also this lambda term. And I also told you that the calibration has these fluctuations in it, which we tried to get rid of or tame using this non-locality scale. But I wonder whether if one removed the curvature term from the causal set action, whether the fluctuation would survive and perhaps be another signature for something for ever-present lambda. I think that would be interesting to explore further.
Understand.
What does it mean to remove the curvature term?
So I guess if we are looking at causal sets approximated by a given space-time, if we can estimate.
So you compute the curvature in the continuum, and then we know.
Or if there's some other sensible way of separating. I don't know the details of what was done in those papers. I haven't personally worked with them, but maybe they also had some good ways of characterizing the curvature, which can then be used to make this division.
On an average, it gives you this. So if you look at the average, for any given realization, you have a function. Even intrinsically, you could, if you knew the ensemble of causal sets, you could intrinsically, within the Clark ensemble,
you
could.
Without having an independent expression, you could just.
Yeah, you could just use the average and then look at the fluctuation. For every given realization, you'd have a fluctuation about the mean, and to use that as your source.
Right. Yeah, so maybe we actually don't want to be getting rid of those fluctuations with this non-locality scale. Maybe it's something physical, which would be this ever-present lambda. And I think it's also interesting because it might also tell us why the mean is zero in addition to why its magnitude is what it is, because it would be the mean of the fluctuations that we are seeing. So it would give us insight to that question as well.
So you mean you wouldn't put in a 2-lambda term there at all?
No,
it's 2-lambda.
That's just for reference. So you would look at the causal set action, you would somehow extract the R part and then study the residue remainder. And see.
Interpret that as a lambda.
So you would expect it to kind of, I guess, grow as square root n for it to be.
Are you saying you can interpret it as a lambda that fluctuates in time, or as in fluctuates across sprinklings?
Well, the ever-present lambda does both, right? So.
Would that make that lambda the scalar field? So you have an action for a scalar field.
I think a scalar field was just an instrument. They kind of they used it and then they discarded it.
But you have a D'Alembertian, which acts on the scalar field.
You could just set it to 1 or something.
Yeah, we set it to a constant to get rid of it.
In the construction of R, you get rid of it. I mean, you use it to get R, but then you say that if you put phi to 1, then you really do get the scalar. That operator gives you the scalar.
The scalar curvature.
That particular operator. So that operator has in it not just the D'Alembertian of the scalar field, but also the curvature. so but that operator has a discrete, you know, discrete term. It's defined for any closed set.
So if we have the action, does it mean we can just derive everything, the rest of the cosmology from it?
Yeah, what's stopping you?
There's one little thing called the sign problem. I don't know, I mean, yeah, you're trying, you're saying do the path integral. Just do it and get the path
integral. Yeah. I guess you could do the Euclidean path integral, but I don't know what you learned from that.
Well,
this is what we do. And we do a stat-make of closed sets.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't know how to interpret it. Like I said, there's
you don't get
when you can do a calculation, the interpretation is murky. When you can't do it, but then there's paths that we think is of conceptually clear, but we just don't know how to calculate anything.
But I guess that's kind of is that.
I can stop here. This is the
probably
point I wanted to get to.
It's a good time.
What are we missing?
Yeah,
I was just gonna talk or just mention list off some other things done with Dalembert.
You should finish off with it.
I didn't finish them.
Okay, so the expressions for the Dalembertians have been generalized to arbitrary dimensions and flat space time. Phenomenology has been studied with them, as Sumati mentioned a bit. Boundary terms for the causal set action have been studied. The stability of evolution dictated by these Dalembertians has been studied. We've also studied spectral geometry with the Dalembertian. So usually spectral geometry is done with the Laplacian. The natural thing to work with in the Lorentzian case is the Dalembertian. We've studied that a bit. And dark matter, you'll hear more about in the action talks on Friday, but that's been studied as well in the context of these Dalembertians. Yeah, I'll just end here. So yeah, there are these indirect lessons we can learn from scalar field theory on a causal set, lessons on how non-locality, retarded operators, and the space-time volume enter the physics, and potentially we can use entanglement entropy to model cosmological homogeneities. And potentially there could be another signature of ever-present lambda in the fluctuations of the causal set action. As I said, this would be interesting because it might both teach us about why the mean is zero and why takes its small value, and it would just be a nice additional confirmation from causal sets of the presence of this ever-present lambda in something intrinsic to the causal set. And there are many other tangential problems that are interesting to cosmology that can be studied with many of the things that I talked about, say the SJ vacuum, entanglement entropy, the action, and the Dalembertian. So, yeah.
Thank you.
For this third idea that was just, I think, very nice, the fact that the fluctuations could be feeding the fluctuations. How do we know that those fluctuations go like, I mean, we don't know how those fluctuations behave with n. So
I've read that they grow, but I don't know as well.
It seems important that if you want to get exactly the sort of values that you have, they need to do.
They need to grow as square root n.
Yeah, as square root n. So if that isn't the case,
I mean, you could also. No, that might well be the case.
Well, that they do grow like square root n?
Might.
Okay.
Might. I mean, we might even know something about it. I just don't remember.
But it's also possible that, I mean, there could be that, you know, if you want to get the right kinds of fluctuations, you mean right sort of size, the since this is phenomenology, putting in a mesoscale may help you also tune it to get the right size fluctuations, because, and it might be already interesting because it tells you that you need the secondary scale. So, you know, it seems very rich. I mean, this idea is very nice, very, something that.
Other questions for Yasaman? Comments? If not, let's thank Yasaman again.